And so we all are paying those the amount of money. So if we are saying that from 100 cases, 40 the cases are used for reentry, so we are spending a lot of money and something that can be used for other things. And one more thing, like what we see last summer with the kids flying from Latin America because they are afraid to be killed or they don't want to be part of a cartel or they don't want to be part of the maras. So, I mean, this is something that is going to keep happening. So we had to think about it that the immigration is something that has been happening as long that humanity has been on Earth. So we've been migrating from one side to another side. So just to put borders is not helping the progress. It's actually bringing more insecure, a more high risk to the country. I'm going to quote one phrase from a statement that was on the Council of the Affairs on 2003, that this retired Coast Guard say that just putting more militarization on the border is not going to make the country secure. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's going to bring the money and the resources that the cartels or the organized crime needs to buy arms or to buy power. So they are creating a really bad places. The border right now is worse than before.
We're out of time for tonight, but I want to thank both Rosa Navarro and Ricardo Varela for joining us on Labor Radio. Our engineer tonight's been Mike. Thank you for listening. Tune in again next week.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Coming up next, it is Prison Pipeline here at KBOO Portland, so stay tuned.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight we'll be airing part two of a talk given by Maya Shenhua on February 9th at Portland State University. Maya read from and spoke about her new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work, and How It Can Do Better. Maya is the editor-in-chief of Truth Out, an independent news and commentary source at truth-out.org. Her initial reading and commentary was aired in part one of this event on February 23rd. Part two begins with a response from Professor Rachel Cunliffe of PSU. We'll begin with Professor Thomas Hastings, who organized the event, introducing Rachel Cunliffe. After Rachel's commentary, Maya will engage with the audience.
Rachel Cunliffe teaches in the conflict resolution graduate program and undergraduate program. She's the director of the undergraduate program, and her background is out of criminology, and she's done a lot of work with death row inmates, and in fact is the spiritual advisor of some of them. She's a British Quaker, so her natural inclination is to basically say stop with the death penalty, but beyond that, she's taken it to several levels, I think, done a lot of work with victims' families and perpetrators' families in very unique ways.
So I'm Rachel Cunliffe. I'm a professor in the Conflict Resolution Program, where my specialism is in restorative justice and in program evaluation. Thank you very much for your talk. What you have to say is so important. It's important because we all need to understand that we aren't trapped by the institutions that already exist. we can think of our institutions as something that we create as a culture, but they also, to a certain extent, create us. And there is this reciprocal relationship between the two, in that when we have a criminal justice system that functions the way that it currently does, we may find ourselves very limited in our imagination about what we could be doing instead, because that seems to be how it is. And I think it's very important for us to be really constantly questioning what we're doing. And certainly the numbers of people incarcerated, the demographics of the people incarcerated, the reasons why people are incarcerated, the law, that, you know, even in this legislative session here, we have this constant sort of to and fro of, you know, more harshness is needed. No, wait, there's something else we could be doing, but then how do we fund that? And so there is a sort of constant tension between what should be done and what other people think should be done. And so that we have a sort of, and I think we see this tension worked out in many arenas in America between a fairly authoritarian response to things and a more liberal response to things. Nevertheless, there is a great deal of dependence on prison, because there is, in my view, in this culture, there is a strong impetus on people locating problems in people. And so we deal with the person, then we deal with the problem. And so we really don't have to worry about the context in which the problem may be occurring, or the sort of the conflict assessment of this whole system, which actually produces people who create problems for other people in the system. So how could we be thinking that perhaps even it's the system that's producing these people and the relationships that we all think we have to have with one another, rather than actually individuals who have some sort of deficiency or pathology which makes them into these disruptive and uncooperative folks? So I'm speaking from the experience that I have doing restorative justice capacity building, in particular in capital cases. So I work almost exclusively in death penalty cases, trying to increase the opportunity for some more restorative outcome than a death sentence. I'm opposed to the death penalty, I should be clear about that. Maybe that won't be surprising to you. But what I have found is that there are many people in the criminal justice system, and by that I'm referring to law enforcement, courts and corrections, who also see that there is much that is wrong, and many of them who have vocationally chosen to go into the system with the intention of changing it. But it's extremely resistant to change. Systems tend to be very resistant to change. But the other thing that we know about systems is that very small amounts of movement can create huge changes on the other side of the system. So we should take heart from that. And as I say, that there are large numbers of people who really are trying to make a difference, do things differently, see that the way that business has been being done is not actually producing the outcomes that were ever intended. And I think this is part of the problem, is that we haven't got a clear understanding of what the outcomes are that we think we want from the criminal justice system. What are we really actually thinking is going to happen? They seem to be very limited objectives of just, like, get this person off the street, and then at least for the period of time this person's not on the street, we won't have this person recidivating. But after that, then, oh, rats, they're out, so let's watch them really carefully because they're for sure going to recidivate, and then we can grab them again and just put them inside for some more time. And that solves the problem, because the problem is in the person. But that's not true in my view. And so we have enormous challenges ahead of us if we really think that we're going to start to change that thinking, because this institution and this system is created out of our thinking about people who offend, people who are victimized and what they need. I think large numbers of people advocate for very harsh punishment because they believe that meets the needs of victims, and that it will keep other potential victims safe, without understanding that actually it's the community cohesion and really coming together as groups of people to share in the same moral norms that is what will make our places that we want to spend time in safer for us to be in, for everyone. And that simply thinking about inclusion, that means if you do it the way I do it, then you're welcome to join. And changing that, and really beginning to think about consultation and how we can collaborate with people to create the new places in which we need to live. These are some of the reframings that I think that you're really relying on. Years ago, Niels Christie wrote an article called Conflicts as Property. And he wrote it in 1977, and in it he really laid out what some of the fundamental challenges he saw ahead were. And one of them, the main problem that he addresses, is the fact that the criminal justice system appropriates the conflicts that occur between people as they're rubbing along just trying to live their lives. That appropriation is called criminalization. And what it does is it allows the community and people who've been hurt, who've been harmed, to abdicate their responsibility for their own direction and for sorting out their own problems. And the criminal justice system creates a sort of gateway to prevent people from actually being involved in their own problem solving. That's exactly at the gateway that I do most of my work, with learning that people who've been victimized by serious crime, for example, are not allowed to meet the offender. It's like, well, wait, what's that about? It's particularly if this person is in their family or is in their circle of friends. What? You can't meet? Why can't we have a conversation? This is the natural thing that would happen here among decent people, is that someone would express remorse for what's happened and they would try and figure out what to do now to set things right as much as possible. And yet, particularly when it becomes a capital case, there may be 3 or 4 years before they'll even encounter each other in a courtroom. These are very long periods of time in human lives for people to be suffering with a loss that is not explained and not understood. And so my belief is that we really do need to create openings for people to come together and try to at least contribute and supplement a criminal justice process if it's determined that that's necessary. And I don't think it's very likely in any of our lifetime that aggravated murder would be thought of as a suitable crime to just move into the community. And we have to be cautious about the wisdom of ordinary people, because we have had history where the wisdom of ordinary people has resulted in lynching and those kinds of things. So we certainly have to be cautious about how we go about this. But I really appreciate the work that you've done, and this book as a strong and lasting voice, which is encouraging us to really be imaginative and look at these very imaginative projects that are happening, which are enrolling the resources of the whole community in responding to these kinds of harms. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Rachel.
So, if people have thoughts, ideas, questions, anything, yeah.
One thought is that more and more the interface between journalists like you, who are really looking at a problem and you're identifying pieces of the solution, I think that are very interesting. Some academic needs to begin a database, because what you're creating is the dots. And somebody needs to figure out at some point how to connect them, or at least show how they could be connected, because it needs a holistic response. And that was what was so exciting and inspiring to me about the last half of your book, was, wow, I never heard of this in this school, this safe room. And the students are excited about that, and they're coming there before the violence now, rather than only coming to that safe room to talk things out after somebody's been, you know, smacked down. This kind of stuff is unique, and I was like, how do we identify this and get these models replicated?
Yeah, I mean, that was something that I was really struck by when I started doing this research, because mostly before I wrote this book, I had been looking at the problem end of things, and I was really struck by the fact that there was no collection specifically of, like, the more radical type solution. And I say radical in a really loose sense. Like, what Tom's referring to is this program at a school in Chicago that actually is happening at an increasing number of schools, where they have, instead of enhancing their security on the police end, they've gone this route, and this comes from an outside force, not the school system, of establishing a peace room where kids come to resolve conflicts restoratively. And the kids who've been doing it since they were young, you know, it's been in place maybe 4 years, and the ones that have been doing it, like, since they came into the school, have gotten so into the habit that when they sense, oh, maybe a problem is
starting with a friend, or I'm having like impulses toward violence or whatever it might be, they go to the peace room initially.
So cool.
And like these kinds of programs, they're not being documented in a large way. You're right. They're being documented like, okay, well, here's a study, and even these are really rare, of like restorative justice programs in two schools in Chicago. So I think you're right about that. My frustration with academia, and not to diss you guys, but like,
bring it on.
I don't know. I was talking in Ithaca College and accidentally really insulted a professor. But I mean, I think my problem is that sometimes what's written about prisons is kind of theoretical, you know, or it's theoretical, and then examples are given that are like famous examples, you know, so it'll be like, oh, Amy Beal in South Africa, like there's this story that's told again and again, really important Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, you know, but they're not getting at like the projects that are not being documented, and to me some of those are the most important because they're happening right at the community level, and that's the level that we need to be dealing with most problems. People who know each other, dealing with things in the ways that are actually functional and make sense within particular communities. And so, yeah, I wish more of that research was happening.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight, I'm airing audio of Maya Chenoir. She's discussing job training programs in prisons.
Prisons. Sometimes, and like the one my sister was in was totally under-resourced, they didn't even have this, they'll have like training programs, you know, particularly in federal prisons where they're like job training, people learn skills, sometimes they're good, and they make it seem as if that helps people get jobs. But they come out and then the jobs are not available because, you know, they have a record, sometimes there's even a box on job applications that they have to check off. And I think what's been most helpful is community organizations that do the direct work of connecting people with jobs. So not just preparing them for interviews or like, come in, we'll do a mock interview, which has been a lot better. We'll help you find clothes to wear to your interviews. Well, if you're not getting interviews, that's not helpful. So like there are a few places, like in Chicago, we have the Safer Foundation. In New York, there's the Fortune Society. In big cities, I've noticed that like more options are developing for reentry programs, but a lot of those actually temporarily went out the window when the financial crisis hit. It was like, okay, well, these people are lowest priority. Yeah, so it's really, I mean, at this point about personal connections and like a few isolated examples. My sister, I guess... my parents are helping to support her, but she's been doing really great and taking care of her daughter and I think moving forward in a great way. And actually now, like since the book came out, she's been getting requests to speak places, and yeah, I've been able to like link her up with some stuff, and she's doing activism, and that's exciting too. I've seen that actually be a route for people to, you know, eventually get work. Other stuff? Yeah.
Do you do any research, and could you possibly speak any on the effect the privatization of prisons has had, you know, with companies like CCA and Geo Group and whatnot, you know, since they started in the 90s? Has that led to an exponential increase in our prison population, with contracts with the Bureau of Prisons and states and whatnot? And also, say anything possibly about prisons and our judicial system being used more and more as mental health facilities. Instead of treating people for mental illness, we just put them in a box.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think private prisons are really, like, interesting and horrifying development. The thing that I've noticed, so I don't think that the rise of private prisons has been the number one force behind mass incarceration. I think that's been a combination of the drug war and different forms of racist social control that have kind of like shifted from Jim Crow and this law and order politics that for most of the past 35 years, that's been something that has gotten people elected. I think that corporations have benefited extraordinarily from prisons, and I think even more than private prisons, which definitely are becoming a really insidious and increasing element in the system, it's been about the way corporations benefit from public prisons. Contracts for food, phone companies, construction companies, healthcare, like all of these things, companies are benefiting, most of them. Before the talk started, we were chatting a little bit about the phone companies that have monopolies in prisons, and they charge these exorbitant rates. And they're taking advantage of people who have very little money. Most people in prison and families of prisoners, you know, they don't have much. And that is something that I think is just one of the sickest things about this system is how it's profit on the backs of people who have the least. And so I think in terms of how, I guess, prison intersects with capitalism, it's kind of like that mentality is really pervasive through all of it. It's a lot of it is about profit, private prisons and beyond. Other thing about private prisons, they've been instrumental in driving immigrant detention. And detention centers are really jails, you know. And the privatization of those detention centers has just, it's proliferated. And now they're building family jails, family detention centers, these private companies where it's like, I mean, they're incarcerating five-year-olds. So, and, you know, that's profitable. And you look at these companies' business plans, and they're like, you know, very straightforward about that. The more people we detain, the more money we get. So, yeah, I could go on and on about that. But, yeah, mental health. I think the thing about that issue gets to the core of some of the things we were talking about earlier, where building a different world beyond prison is not just about knocking prison down, it's about raising up not only alternatives to dealing with conflict, but a world where people are cared for. If people are cared for, you're going to see a lot less harm. You're going to see a lot less violence, and you're going to see fewer survival crimes, too. And so I think mental health care, the way that it's been diminished, it's part of this destruction of the public sphere. Public benefits are no longer seen as valuable in the same way. And that's seen as something that's expendable. And the prisons, the way that they've become a solution, are just like kind of recategorizing people, especially people of color. In a lot of ways, people of color with mental illness have always been dealt with by the criminal justice system. It's more been white people who've been sent to institutions. But increasingly, it's just been this push toward jail. And so what we're seeing in Chicago, it's recently come to the attention of people who are paying attention that the Cook County Jail is the largest mental health care provider in the state. Now, how do you define a mental health care provider? Well, it's people who are mentally ill in a place where they're getting treatment, but they're not getting the kind of treatment that's actually facilitating them getting better. What you see in a lot of prisons is that people with mental illness are put in solitary confinement, and all the research on solitary confinement shows that it actually exacerbates mental illness. I mean, that's such an obvious point. There's more and more research around it. It's like, we don't need more research. It's so obvious. But, and the UN says it's torture, but that's something that we do to protect people. It's just, it's a really, really wrongly devised mindset, but people accept it because that's the way it is.
So I've been in segregation myself, and what I found, and it was a short period of time, just a couple weeks, but what I found was that the longer I was in
isolation, the more flaky my brain became. It was like I was still able to read a few things.
Yeah.
It's like I wasn't connecting reality to the reading the way I would normally connect it. And I've been in touch correspondence with prisoners for many, many years, and the ones who are in the SHU, in the Fed system, or in segregation in the state systems, I can see the same thing in their correspondence. The longer they're in, the more drifty their letters get, and it's like you do lose, it exacerbates any sort of dissonance and any sort of disconnection with reality the longer you are in isolation.
Yeah, I have a pen pal who's in the SHU at Pelican Bay in California, and he's been in solitary confinement for years. And all he does, so he describes it as it's like being locked in the bathroom, but you have a television. And then you're in there 23 hours a day, no contact. And then for an hour a day, you're let out into like basically a different cell that's outside for recreation. And definitely you can tell he's got some problems now. But also his whole world is based on what he sees on television in this way that like his letters are just telling me like what's going on in the same rerun, you know. And he also says he wants to kill himself, you know, which is understandable. And just thinking about like that's a life, you know, that's profound. Other thoughts?
I think we're out of time. Yeah, and I really want to thank you very much, Maya.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Amy Johnson. This concludes the Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work, and How We Can Do Better talk. Before we end tonight's show, I wanted to share a little bit about an upcoming workshop series this summer. I'm sitting here with Carol Mani today. She's a professor of English at the University of Portland, and she's offering a free series of workshops for family members of inmates. It's called With You on the Journey. I wonder if you would tell us when the event is happening and a little bit about the workshops.
Okay, well, first of all, they're writing workshops. There will be six of them starting in mid-June and going through the end of July on Sunday afternoons at the First Unitarian Church, which is in downtown Portland, and they'll go from around 1:30 to 3 or 3:30.
There's also a performance at the end of it. Could you tell us a little bit about that and also a little bit about why you're offering this?
Yeah, well, this is a project specifically for family members of people in prison or in juvenile detention or in jail. I myself am in that category. I've had a family member who's been incarcerated, and having had that experience is why I've decided to do this, and also because I've been a writing teacher for about 20 years. I want to give family members of people in prison a chance to be with each other and share experiences and write about their experiences, and that's really the main reason for the project. But also at the end of it, in October, we're doing a performance of the writing that the participants have done in the writing workshops. And that will also be at the First Unitarian Church downtown, also on a Sunday afternoon on October 11th. And the purpose of that is to educate the public about the experience of being the family member of someone in prison. Each participant will get a $100 stipend at the end of the performance as a thank you for participating. And I'm less concerned with whether you think that you can write well as I am with finding people who want to explore their experience and who can participate in all six of the writing workshops. If they feel shy about being part of the performance, we will try to find someone else to read what they've written. But I do want them to come to all of the workshops.
We already have the information about the workshop posted on our Facebook, so you can find out a little bit more about the dates there and email us at kboppc KBOOPPC@gmail.com. If you want to be a participant, KBOOPPC, Prison Pipeline Collective, @gmail.com, or we're on Facebook and you can send us a message there and I'll get you in touch with Carol so that you can get started in joining the workshop. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs, including Part 1 of Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better, at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, Maya Chenoir and Rachel Cunliffe, and Tom Hastings for organizing the event they spoke at. I would also like to thank Carol Imani for speaking with me about With You on the Journey, her upcoming writing workshops. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
It's 7 p.m. here at KBOO Portland. Keep it tuned. Next is Hard Knock Radio.
No man live unto himself, for all living things are bound by cords to every other living thing. Blessed are the pure at heart, for they will love and not demand love in return. Peace be still, this is Azeem, checking in for Hard Knock Radio. Be there.